Well, good afternoon. I'm very delighted to be giving this talk today. Any science and faith conference in the Canadian context really should have something about Sir John William Dawson. And so I hope by the time I'm done, you will understand why I think that way. So it's the bottom one that is to change? There's the top one. It'll be the top one. Thank you. So I'm going to frame this talk with words from two psalms. One is Psalm 71:17, O God, thou hast taught me from my youth, and hitherto I've declared thy wondrous works. This verse was placed in the flyleaf of Dawson's autobiography, 50 years of work in Canada, scientific and educational. The other psalm is from 104:24. O Lord, thou, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. This verse, which we will encounter again, was placed by Sir William Dawson as an illuminated plaque at the entrance of the Peter Redpath Museum of Natural History at McGill University, and that was at its inauguration in 1882. Who was Sir J. William Dawson? Well, sadly, this is not an unusual question. Dawson, as you might discover, was a great many people. He was born in Nova Scotia in 1820, and he was educated there and also for short stints in Edinburgh, Scotland. First of all, Dawson was an educator. Though he was trained initially as an exploration geologist, Joseph Howe of Confederation fame asked him to become Nova Scotia's first education superintendent. He was lured to the job by Howe, noting how much of the province's rocks Dawson could explore while he was out about doing his work. He did both very effectively, such that in 1855, he received an offer to become McGill's fifth principal. At the time, the school was basically a few dilapidated buildings set amongst a cow pasture. By Dawson's retirement in 1893, a dozen buildings had been added, staff had been increased eightfold, higher education for women had been introduced, and McGill had become known as the Harvard of the North. Well, and he also befriended significant benefactors with family names like Redpath and Molson. Dawson was a scientist. He published over 300 scientific papers in his career. He became a member of the Royal Society in 1862, thanks to sponsorship by Charles Darwin. And there was a touch of irony there. He was the founding president of the Royal Society of Canada in 1882. And the same year, he was elected president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And 4 years later, he became the president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. And he's the only person ever to have held both titles. In the year of his retirement, in 1893, he became president of the Geological Society of America. Hence, Dawson was also a geologist. As a boy, and encouraged by his father, he loved exploring nature and collecting fossils. In the 1840s and 1850s, he met up with two very famous geologists, Britain's Sir Charles Lyell and Canada's Sir William Logan. And he toured them around his favorite exposures, most notably the Joggins exposure at the Bay of Fundy, as shown here. And this is my son and I enjoying the same kind of field trip. Here, as you can see, geology can be read literally like a book, with the pages exposed for over 12 kilometers. One of Dawson's first books was Acadian Geology. It was first published in 1855, and it went through four editions and a great deal of expansion, and it remained an authoritative guide for several decades. Dawson was also an evangelical Presbyterian. He had a very strong religious upbringing through a family who were ardent supporters of the evangelical free church movement in Scotland. As we will see, participants in that movement, as pictured here, had a considerable influence on Dawson's thinking. And I'll talk about this picture again a little later. A further sign of Dawson's religious tendencies came when Dawson, as an influential elder at Erskine Presbyterian Church of Montreal, became immersed in an 1870s version of Worship Wars. The organ was becoming a popular instrument in church services, It was especially attracting young people. They were losing interest in the staunch metrical solemnity of the traditional Scottish services. Well, when the organ was introduced at Erskine Church, Dawson led a contingent of parishioners out of the church and away from it to form a new Stanley Street Presbyterian church for singing in the church. For Dawson, he was quite happy with the tuning fork and the five basic metrical tunes for the Psalms, and nothing but the Psalms. Dawson was a foremost apologist for science and Christian faith, and that's why I enjoy talking about him. A good many of his 25 books that he wrote featured this theme. A range of titles are shown here and clearly defines this. Like on the Nature in the Bible in 1875, and on the Origin of the World According to Revelation of Science and Revelation and Science in 1877. Points of Contact Between Revelation and Natural Science in 1885. Modern Ideas of Evolution Related to Revelation and Science in 1890, and so forth. Dawson's training and thinking was influenced by a great many people. As I have mentioned, he was privileged to befriend a number of key developers of old Earth geology in the mid-1800s. Dawson's science and faith apologetic was really influenced most strongly by two Scottish individuals who shared similar denominational leanings, and that's Thomas Chalmers and Hugh Millett. Chalmers was a popular preacher, a chemist, a writer, a philosopher, who as early as the 1820s put forward the gap theory for reconciling the timing of the first chapter of Genesis with the growing understanding of old Earth geology. Chalmers placed a major time gap between the days of Genesis, particularly day one and day two. Hugh Miller was a stonemason, a writer, and a journalist, and a fossil fish authority. Miller wrote a number of apologetic books concerning geology and Genesis, including The Footprints of the Creator, that was in 1847, and The Testimony in the Rocks in 1857. Dawson's own review of that latter book contained high praise, noting it was the best guide for the reconciliation of science and scripture. In his books, Miller laid out what is defined as the day-age theory, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, whereby each day of the Genesis account is representative of vast periods of time, also roughly corresponding to the geological ages as they were being understood in the mid-1800s. Dawson was particularly struck by Miller's views and for the most part adopted them. And I say for the most part because Dawson, well, he disagreed with Miller on some of the specific designations. What Miller suggested corresponded to day three, Dawson saw as day five. I simply find it intriguing to imagine this discussion going on in the 1840s and the 1850s. Now, I want to take a moment to share some Presbyterian history with you. We see this picture once again. This picture is the very first General Assembly of the Free Church of Scotland, taken at the time of what is known as the Great Disruption in the Church of Scotland in 1843. Now, this was the evangelical wing of the denomination, and I simply want to point out that front and center is Thomas Chalmers, right here. I know the picture is kind of fuzzy, but believe me, that's him. And down here, front and center, or front to the side, writing away, is Hugh Miller. So I simply illustrate this. I find it intriguing that it was the evangelical branch of the church and its leadership who were at the forefront of the Genesis and geology reconciliation at this time. Dawson's first major apologetic was published in 1860. It was entitled Archaea, Studies in the Cosmology and Natural History of the Hebrew Scriptures. This was just a year after Darwin had published On the Origin of Species. So over the next little while, Dawson somewhat revised the text, but more significantly changed the title to now become An Origin of the World, According to Revelation and Scripture, and that was published in 1877. And the use of the word origin in the title was highly intentional. in the intervening time Dawson had become a strict critic of Darwinian processes, although he was a very strong supporter of a progressive and continual development of life forms as directed by the Creator over a period of millions of years. In Origin, Dawson cites the Psalms at least 20 times. Most prominent in use is Psalm 104, and what he and many others call the Great Hymn of Creation. Dawson also references this psalm in at least six other of his books. He defines this psalm as the oldest extant commentary on Genesis 1, and he says it can be viewed as simply as the poetic version of the narrative of creation. The phrasing and sentiment of this psalm, in Dawson's view, reflects the fact that there was no idea in the mind of the writer of a short period of time for the creation act, but rather reflected long consecutive processes. Dawson supports his opinion by also referencing Psalm 90. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And Dawson suggests that the word everlasting, or olam in Hebrew, is better translated as age, because the related word olamen means eon. Hence, the phrase should better read, from age to age, thou art God. And in his mind, Dawson's mind, this denotes longer periods of time, particularly compared to that as allocated to humanity. Dawson considers that the grand conceptions of the geology and astronomy and earth history from that period were already embodied in the Hebrew revelations. And he states that the other writers of the Old Testament understood the creative days in this sense might be inferred from the entire absence of any reference to a work of creation as short. Such references we may find in modern writers, but never in Scripture. He goes on to say, we shall only lament that so many pious and learned interpreters of Scripture have been so little acquainted with nature to appreciate the natural history of the Book of God, or adequately to illustrate it to those who depend on their teaching. Ouch. So in following Miller's day 8 sequence, Dawson makes extensive use of the Psalms, again particularly Psalm 104, to support progressive nature of the creation event. God's first action was speaking the creation of light. And though illuminating, as he says, but a waste of lifeless waters, God nonetheless saw that the light was good. The initial light and its goodness is reflected in the opening of Psalm 104, which states, thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who coverest thyself with light as a garment. That God would choose to wear light is an affirmation of this earliest physical act of creation and its inherent goodness. And several other psalms are added to support this. Psalm 104, there we go, also lays out some principles for the creation action of day 2. Here the focus is on the expanse called heaven. Who stretches out the heavens like a curtain? Who maketh clouds his chariot? Who walketh upon the wings of the wind? Here Dawson once again references the Hebrew mind as being altogether remote from any sense of the archaic notion of a solid or arched firmament, the common and accepted premise of the ancient world. Thus, the psalmist is more closely aligned to the scientific norm. Dawson also invokes Psalm 104 to help interpret the creative actions of day 3. The waters stood above the mountains, at thy rebuke they fled, at the sound of thy thunder they wasted away. Mountains ascended and valleys descended. And here Dawson clearly sees the basic geological processes at work, including some specifics not even referred to in Genesis, such as volcanic action. This process is again referred to a little later in Psalm 104 and verse 32, wherein God looketh on the earth and it trembled. He toucheth the hills and they smoke. And in a similar way, there is a scene in Psalm 18. Smoke went up from his nostrils, fire from his mouth devoured. Dawson notes that even before the presence of life, God said that it was good. And I quote, to our view, that primal dry land would scarcely seem good. Bare rocky peaks, active volcanoes, vast mud flats. Yet it was good in the view of the Maker, who would see it in relation to the use for which he had made it, and as fit preparatory steps to the wonders that he would soon introduce. Now, day four takes an interesting twist as the focus is back on the heavens. And Dawson notes here that after what he calls so long a sojourn on earth, we are carried again to the heavens. And while he questions why the completion of the heavenly bodies was so long delayed, he uses the Psalms to provide some answers. The luminaries were appointed to their office on the fourth day. He writes, they are not said to have been created on the fourth day, being included in creation from the beginning, but they are now completed and fully fitted for their work. Now, the ultimate purpose of the luminaries is outlined in several Psalms, and I'm sure we're familiar with, probably all of them. Their use in this context will, of course, be familiar, and I would simply remind you that we are talking about comments from the late to mid to late 1800s here. For instance, Psalm 18 answers his own question of what are we that God would be mindful of us by comparing the cosmos to the breadth and length of God's love for humanity. And similarly in Psalm 147, who telleth the number of stars? Well, God's infinite understanding is simply a prelude to lifting up the meek. And Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, perhaps the most commonly used psalm to illustrate this pattern, is one that will be quite familiar to you. And Dawson adds to this, it is but a barren and fruitless philosophy which seeks the word and not the author, a narrow piety which loves God but despises his works. The Bible holds forth the golden mean between these extremes in a strain of lofty poetry and acute perception of the great and beautiful, whether seen in the Creator or reflected in his works. Dawson returns to Psalm 104 and invokes a later portion to introduce creation of the lower animals from day five. And here he uses a favorite phrase that we have heard already from the Redpath Museum, O Lord, how manifold are thy works. And it concludes, the earth is full of thy riches. Dawson has taken this line, the earth is full of thy riches, completely to heart. He suggests, witness the preservation in the rocks of the fossil remains of extinct creatures, as if he who made them was unwilling that the evidence of their existence should perish, and purposely treasured them through all the revolutions of the earth, that through them humanity might magnify his name. There's maybe some echoes here from Ben McFarland's fine talk this morning. Dawson notes that the psalmist would appear to have all of these thoughts in his mind as he poured out his wonder in writing the 104th Psalm. Dawson expands on this theme in his book Nature and Bible for day six, this time quoting from Psalm 139, and that psalm states, my substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought from the depths of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect. Gosson goes so far as to suggest that the writer at least had in his mind prototypes of humanity, which geology, he says, has recovered from the rocks of the earth. Dawson did much of his writing and hence reflection at the family summer cottage located on the shores of the St. Lawrence River. And his granddaughter would later recall times around the evening bonfires and the shiny dimes that would appear from Dawson's pocket when the children would successfully recite certain psalms. I don't doubt that Psalm 104 might merit an extra prize, and it perhaps maintains campfires are a little different these days, I suppose. Dawson loved the Psalms, and he used them often. They were for him a window on the creative human and Hebrew mind. This was a mind that was unencumbered by any time constraints. When the Psalms are used as a commentary on Genesis 1, one could sense the vast timescales that coincided with the developments of old earth geology. And these were rapidly being discovered and affirmed by those who perceived it all as a tribute to an awesome and a patient God. Dawson was also carrying on the tradition established in Scotland, whereby it was the evangelical wing of the Presbyterian tradition that was at the forefront of reconciling old earth geology with the sequence of creation events as portrayed in Genesis 1. Now, Sir William Dawson's work as principal for 39 very significant years at McGill University is well recognized. But many people wonder why the same level of recognition has not been given to Dawson for his scientific or his apologetic contributions. Well, scientifically, Dawson struggled with the concept of things like continental glaciation. He could not accept strict Darwinian processes of evolution. He also vested much research and writing in the promotion of a Precambrian fossil he named Eozoon canadense, or Dawn Life of Canada, for which most, but certainly not all, examples were shown essentially to be pseudo-fossils, and that is, they were simply non-biogenic metamorphic structures. Dawson died in November 19, 1899. By the turn of the century, much of Dawson's apologetic was actually becoming unnecessary. Most scientists of faith had no problems reconciling Genesis 1 with the age and the development of the earth. Nonetheless, Sir William Dawson left behind a very rich and valued legacy of Christian apologetics as applied to modern science and especially to geology. It comprises a substantial portion of that kind of work carried on in the 19th century in Canada and has much to commend it for studies today. In fact, the openlibrary.org has 332 published items of Dawson's books and papers that one can refer to, and I recommend it. Now, I suspect that one valued lesson might be from Dawson, that for those leading Bible studies on the interpretation of Genesis 1, that it would be prudent to first study and discuss the various creation texts within the Psalms before jumping into the more controversial, if you like, or trickier aspects of Genesis 1. Now, if Dawson could join us for the conference this weekend, I know that he would be intrigued by the content of the talks here. But, you know, I suspect he would be deeply saddened by the fact that here we are, 104 years after publishing The Origin of the World, and we still find we have the need to help Christians reconcile the meaning of Genesis 1 with the glory of God as revealed in the wonders of 4.5 billion years of God's creative mastery. So I guess really in Dawson's honor, I'm simply going to end with his favorite psalmic phrase. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom thou hast made them all, and the earth is full of thy riches. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob. Now this question of mine.
I wondered about, Robert, about day two.
Yes.
Well, I wondered what made you say that the firmament, that as it was visualized on day two, was not solid.
Right. Well, I wish Dennis Lamoureux was here, because he has some wonderful graphic illustrations of the thinking back then in his book, where the firmament is a solid sphere. But Dawson maintained, since it talks about God moving amongst the clouds, and several references within that first part of Psalm 104, that there was nothing solid about it. So Dawson was simply saying, there's nothing solid up there. And the Hebrew mind didn't consider that there was anything solid. And that was God's realm. But Dawson would include everything from the atmosphere on up.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Why is it that we do so little celebrating of a Canadian genius?
That's a very good question. I appreciate the question. I have no answer. I would suggest at the turn of the century, Dawson scientifically, unfortunately, was perceived as being very old school, and that he really persisted in some of his thinking, i.e. about evolution and Darwinian processes. He continued to his death to believe in this Eozoon canadense, which intrigues me greatly, because indeed, there are some samples that have been proven to be just simply a metamorphic feature. But he identified Precambrian life in this way. And indeed, there are samples of his rocks from Ontario, from Perth County, which people are saying, yeah, that was a Precambrian life form. And of course, we now recognize Precambrian life form. So, but at the time, he was just kind of put aside. And as I said, well recognized at McGill for his work, obviously, but it is sad. Sir William Logan has a mountain now named after him. There's Dawson College in Montreal. Dawson City was named after his son, George Mercer Dawson, who headed up the Geological Society, Geological Survey of Canada at one point. But I appreciate your question, and I wish there was even a Dawson Society where more, because all of this material, 25 books and well over 300 articles that you can work away at, correspondence, the whole thing. Yeah. Good question.
Any other questions?
Yes, Ben.
Why was he so opposed to Darwinism? Did he ever like signs of considering changing his views on that, or was he just...
There are some authors, some biographers have said, yes, either he was showing signs, or if he had been able to live continuously just by knowing how he thinks, that he may well have kind of come around. But he objected for two main reasons. One, he constantly, maybe three, he constantly maintained that there was no physical proof for Darwinian processes that you could go and see. That's nothing new. Secondly, he said, as many others have recognized, that on the origin of species, really species didn't talk about the origin at all, just talked about what happened after the origin. So he had problems with that part of it. And then there are many, and I think quite rightly, he had such a strong faith in God that he just wouldn't accept anything that spoke of anything that didn't necessarily require God. But he was a very firm believer in an ancient earth and in the progress of different animals through time and progress and that sort of thing.
Great. Our time is up. Thank you very much.
Okay.